Marketplace is produced in association with the University of Southern California.
14 days, 14 long days, we've been talking about the shutdown and the debt limit. Now, maybe, there's a deal. Emphasis on the maybe here. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace.
Make it a working lunch. Listen to the Marketplace Midday Update podcast for the day's top business headlines. Subscribe on iTunes or at marketplace.org/podcasts.
From the Frank Stanton Studios in Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. This is the Marketplace podcast for Monday, the 14th of October. Great, as always, to have you here. You know, it's almost like Kremlinology, this shutdown debt limit stuff. Like when you had to figure out what was going on with the Soviet Union by who was standing next to who at all the big parades. Exhibit A today was a meeting between President Obama and congressional leaders of both parties that was mysteriously postponed amid signs of, quote, progress. We are told. Sudeep Reddy has been covering the goings-on for the Wall Street Journal. He is in our Washington bureau. Now, hey, Sudeep.
Hey, Kai.
So what's the latest, man? What do we know right now?
We know that at least the Senate leaders are inching toward a deal. They've been far apart for a while throughout this two-week shutdown, letting the politics play out. They finally realize, as they come very close to the really dangerous moment of default, that they need to come together. And so they've been expressing an air of optimism on the Senate floor today. They've been saying they're both optimistic. The fact that a meeting was postponed could be a good thing or a bad thing. They're still hashing out the details, but at least they're talking. These are, as we've always expected, the two adults in the room who would eventually have to step up and strike some kind of a deal to prevent devastating damage. We're not there yet, though, which is the problem.
Harry Reid and Mitch McConnell, of course. What do we know about the parameters, I guess, of a deal?
We don't know all the details, but we know that they're looking likely to kick the can a little bit further down.
No, I can't believe you said that.
That's what they're going to do. They're going to at least get the ideal is to get the government open again to extend the debt ceiling for some period of time. That remains undetermined. But we're going to be arguing about this again in November, December, or January in some fashion, given the number of components involved in this.
One of those components is the sequester, which was a big deal a year ago or you know, 10-ish months ago, and then kind of faded from everybody's memory. So we're in that zone now where we're actually talking grand bargain and big deficit reduction negotiations, I guess?
We are talking about those again, which is what makes me very nervous, because every time we've had a big discussion and try to actually accomplish something big, we've always failed in it. And it never happens, and it leads to giant explosions in the end that gets everybody depressed all over again. And the better solution here in terms of what's workable may yet be to just figure out another short-term fix, because we are so close to some critical deadlines that if you keep pushing for a big deal, you might end up with nothing but a lot of crying.
Okay, but here's a lot of crying. Yeah, wouldn't you love to see that? Here's the thing I don't understand about that. If everybody knows, because, you know, for all your insights, you're not the only guy who knows that grand bargains tend to fall apart. If everybody knows that grand bargains are so difficult, why is everybody from Jay Carney to Mitch McConnell to Harry Reid expressing confidence that something good is going to happen here?
They're expressing confidence because the alternative to actually get out there and start sniping again will start the market panic that everybody knows they need to avoid. That's the game here that they're all playing. Markets are testing Congress right now. They don't believe Congress is going to allow a devastating default and don't want to get involved in a trade and be on the wrong side of it. Congress is testing markets because they don't want to be beholden to Wall Street, and they still want to get their political goals accomplished here. And so you wrap all of that up into a giant discussion and hope something comes out of it in the end, at least in some smaller pieces in the end.
Do you think the markets are consciously, and I know this is like anthropomorphizing the markets to an unhealthy degree, but are they giving Congress time to work this thing out? I mean, the Dow is up today. It was only down a little bit at the open.
Most investors are giving time because they aren't really prepared for the unthinkable. They're not prepared for an environment where the United States can't pay its bills due to our own will. And so they're providing this little bit of leeway, but the stock market is a laugh a minute. Like people, there are it's a lot of lemmings. There are people who move around in packs. Credit markets are flashing a lot of warning signs, and credit markets were largely closed today for the holiday.
Market,
and so as we see that on Tuesday, but also there are much deeper problems. There are major investment firms, major money market funds that have been pulling out of treasuries just because of the risk of a default. And when that happens, there are consequences. There are consequences that can last months or years. And we've seemed to deluded ourselves into thinking we can get to the deadline, pass some kind of increase in the debt ceiling, and everything will be fine. There will be damage in the end regardless.
And the bond market opens again for business tomorrow morning. Sudeep Reddy with the Wall Street Journal down in Washington. Thanks, Sudeep.
Thanks, Kai.
All right, we'll see you. So that is the lay of the land as of right now. What about come Thursday, when no less a person than the Secretary of the Treasury has told us the United States won't be able to pay its bills? The prospect of a default, whether slow motion or all at once, has been the boogeyman under the bed. That thing's so terrible that nobody wants to go there, much less talk about it. But Thursday is going to come one way or another, right? So Marketplace's Sabri Benishore takes us there.
Let's just imagine, worst case scenario, the U.S. Treasury misses a payment. Maybe October 17th, maybe a few days later. Eric Stein is with investment management firm Eaton Vance.
You're going to see stock markets in particular sell off.
As markets open that day from Tokyo to New York, they fall, wiping out a lot of wealth along the way. Think about your 401k. Now, when you or I miss a payment on our credit card, our interest rates go up. Same thing would happen here, says Sam Chandon, chief economist at Chandon Economics. Thing is, government interest rates are tied to a lot of other interest rates.
When it gets more expensive for the U.S. government to finance its debt, it gets more expensive for everyone to finance their debt.
Think mortgages, car loans, student debt. And after a while, banks themselves start having trouble. Here's Eric Stein with Eaton Vance.
That could get very, very messy. It really affects the plumbing of the financial system.
Banks use short-term government debt as collateral when they borrow from each other each day to cover people withdrawing money for groceries or payroll or whatever. If they don't have collateral, they can't lend to each other, and they're sure not going to lend to you.
There's a seizing up of the credit markets, and there's less funding that goes out to the real economy, whether that be funding to large corporations, funding for mortgage backs, funding to small companies.
Banks have actually done this before. In 2008, says Michael Farr with Farr Miller Washington.
They stopped lending overnight, and all of a sudden, Lehman Brothers, that was financially viable 2 days before, suddenly went under. So things can move very quickly.
Even flirting with these consequences has consumer confidence down to a 9-month low. But let me just say that most people do not believe the U.S. is going to default. Eric Stein.
Might go to the last second of the last hour, but I think an actual default is very, very unlikely.
Why not? Well, because...
That's really a moronic, stupid thing to do.
In New York, I'm Sabri Benishore for Marketplace.
Oh, man. Fingers crossed, everybody. On Wall Street today, lousy start, better close. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. All right. Do me a favor and forget shutdowns and debt limits and sequester and all the rest of that pesky day-to-day stuff. The question in economics today, by which I mean specifically today, is what's in a price? The Nobel Prize in Economics this year went to three American economists, Robert Shiller at Yale, Eugene Fama, and Lars Peter Hansen at the University of Chicago, for their work on asset prices. That is, why we pay what we pay for everything from a share of Facebook to a ranch-style home with a two-car garage. Marketplace's Stacey Vanek Smith explains why prices are more important now than ever.
At a press conference at Yale today, Nobel laureate Robert Shiller was modest.
I'm still in disbelief.
Economist Paul Kudrowski wasn't. He says it's fitting that pricing takes center stage this year.
So you understand price in economics, you understand very little at all.
Kudrowski says price has only gotten more important. Financial markets have created all kinds of products around the prices of things. Take mortgage-backed securities, the now infamous financial products that were tied to mortgage loans.
And once you start doing that, you create all of these new correlations and new combinations.
When housing prices crashed, many mortgage-backed securities became worthless. Because those products had been sold all over the world, suddenly the price of a house in Tucson, Arizona, was of critical importance to the Italian economy. says Matthew Slaughter, an economist with Dartmouth's Tuck School of Business.
Those assets get traded all over the world, and there's a lot of financial derivatives linked to those real goods and services.
Slaughter says price is why the world is watching Congress now, hoping they will pass a budget. If not, the U.S. could default on its debts, affecting the price of the all-important Treasury bond.
In many ways, in the world economy today, the single most important asset are U.S. Treasury securities.
Treasury bonds have been seen as being totally safe. Investors, companies, and countries all over the world have bought billions of dollars worth of them as a way to guard against risk. If the U.S. defaults on its debts, says Slaughter, the value of those assets would come into question. New Nobel winner Robert Shiller doesn't think it will come to that.
It should be okay. I should add, however, I do not know the future, and I could be wrong.
If Shiller is wrong, the global economy could pay a very high price for the gridlock in Washington. In New York, I'm Stacey Vanek Smith for Marketplace.
Coming up, man versus ticket-buying machine.
You can imagine our shock when Ticketmaster told us there were no tickets left.
But first, let's do the numbers. Signs of progress in Washington today rescued Wall Street. The Dow Industrials opened down nearly 100 points, but it recovered to close up 64 or 0.4%, 15,301 at the bell. The NASDAQ added 23.6%, 3815 there. The S&P 500 put on 6 points, about 0.4%, finished things at 1710. The indices moved modestly on political news, but some stocks moved dramatically on actual business news. Netflix flew up nearly 8% today after the Wall Street Journal reported the company is in talks to make its streaming video service available through cable television. Comcast, a big cable provider, reportedly talking to Netflix, tacked on almost 1% today. The Treasury bond market, as we said while talking to Sudeep, was closed for Columbus Day, but look out tomorrow, gang. You're listening to Marketplace.
Get Marketplace's top headlines, podcasts, and special features delivered right to your inbox each day. Subscribe to the Midday Update newsletter at Marketplace.org.
From the Marketplace Datebook, here's a look at what's coming up Tuesday. We'll get an idea of how popular Pizza Night was in the last quarter. Domino's reports earnings, and so does the Coca-Cola Company. A coalition of veteran and serving members of the military will protest the government shutdown in Washington. And on this day in 1951, I Love Lucy premiered on CBS. If you look, you can probably find a rerun on somewhere. I'm Bridget Bodner.
This is Marketplace from APM. I'm Kai Rizdahl. We talk a lot about reform in this country. Tax reform, immigration reform, healthcare reform, of course. What you don't hear a whole lot about is energy reform. But down in Mexico, the newish president down there, Enrique Peña Nieto, is trying to do what others have tried and failed to get done, reform the Mexican oil industry to allow more foreign investment. Marketplace's Jeff Tyler reports that would be a big change, one that plays right into questions about Mexico's national identity.
In Mexico, Independence Day actually starts the night before. A military band plays as tens of thousands gather in Mexico City's main square, outside the ornate colonial building that houses the president's office. From his balcony, the president leads the crowd, recalling the fathers of the revolution.
Viva Guerrero!
Viva!
Viva la independencia nacional!
Viva!
Viva Mexico!
Viva!
This year, President Enrique Peña Nieto may have considered adding Viva Pemex. That's Mexico's state-run oil company. The president has proposed a constitutional amendment to allow more direct investment in the oil industry by foreign companies. Even though many Mexicans see Pemex as inefficient and corrupt, the company is also seen as a cornerstone in Mexico's economic independence. As the country debates reform, I wanted the perspective from an oil town, so I headed south. Villahermosa is the capital of the state of Tabasco. Just like the sauce, it's hot. Villahermosa is an oil city that grew up around a small town of two-story colonial buildings and narrow streets. That's where I met mariachi Ricardo Barone, standing on the corner waiting for work. The bond between Mexico and its oil industry shows up in all kinds of unexpected places, like this song.
Son tus campiñas petroleras, un primor miles de obreros ahí encuentran protección por la riqueza.
He sings about how the wealth of oil in the countryside protects thousands of workers. I asked Barone what he thinks of the proposal to allow more foreign investments in the oil industry.
Don't privatize it. It should continue to belong to Mexicans. We need to guard it jealously.
Jealously guarding the status quo is not a recommendation you'll hear from industry analysts. In the last 10 years, oil production has fallen by about a million barrels a day. John Padilla is with an international energy consulting firm called IPD Latin America.
You have a company that now has $100 billion of unfunded pension liabilities. You have $60 billion of long-term debt, 151,000 employees for a company that perhaps needs 60,000 employees total.
Many of the untapped oil reserves are under the ocean, in very deep water, requiring technological expertise that Mexico doesn't have. Given these challenges, a company overhaul might seem like a no-brainer. But Pemex is no ordinary company. Consider its founder, Lázaro Cárdenas. In case you don't know who that is, let's stop at this local high school and ask a random 17-year-old.
Lázaro Cárdenas was a president who's known for expropriating the oil industry for the benefit of all Mexicans.
In 1938, Cárdenas kicked out the foreign companies and nationalized the oil industry. Mexico was the first, the model that Iran and other countries followed. His son, Cuauhtémoc Cárdenas, is a political heavyweight in his own right. He's a former governor and a political party leader.
Right now, for example, Pemex contributes almost 35% of fiscal revenues of the government.
Cárdenas says Pemex has been important for Mexico's economy.
Pemex pays its taxes in advance. And every day of the year, Pemex pays about $60 million.
That money goes to pay for things like roads and bridges and schools. If foreign companies played a bigger role in Mexico's oil industry, would they pay the same amount in taxes? Cárdenas opposes giving foreign companies more influence over Mexican oil production. For him, protecting Pemex means protecting future government funding. But in hot and humid Villahermosa, the government funding seems to evaporate. Along the pedestrian shopping mall downtown, I spoke to Javier Hernandez.
I haven't seen a positive change for the rural peasants or the indigenous people. They make promise after promise, but there is no development.
50-year-old lawyer Delfina Gomez says Pemex is bad news for the environment.
When Pemex enters an area, they destroy the place. What we have naturally, in the end, it's finished.
Nonetheless, she doesn't support the proposed reform. Gomez worries that bringing foreign companies into the industry would drive up prices.
It would make gas prices more expensive for us.
The only Mexicans I met who supported reforming the oil industry were people trying to work in the oil industry. They figure more foreign companies means more jobs. But a recent poll shows most Mexicans believe foreign companies would mean less money for them. In Villahermosa, I'm Jeff Tyler for Marketplace.
The idea of mergers and acquisitions, the buying and combining of companies, and sometimes the breaking up of those companies later on, isn't new at all. But over the past couple of decades, M&A, those big deals that can shake entire industries, has become an enormous business in and of itself. John Weir Close is the author of a new book on the topic called A Giant Cow Tipping by Savages, The Boom, Bust, and Boom Culture of M&A. John, welcome to the program.
Thank you.
Lest people think that mergers and acquisitions are boring, dull, and deadly dry Wall Street stuff, I want you to tell us the story of Cornelius Vanderbilt and the New York and Erie Railroad.
He's an example of early M&A that almost turned into an American Civil War in New York.
He wanted the entire railroad stretching from Grand Central to the Erie Canal, and he fought a group called the Erie Gang.
And when you say fought, you mean fought.
Well, I don't think too many shots were fired, but,
but there
money
were
was
clubs
stolen.
And, you know, stuff.
There were clubs, there were private militias, there were bribed legislators, there were judges suborned. And eventually, Mr. Vanderbilt gave up, and he lost $1 million in the process.
All for control of a company.
That's right. I think early M&A spread almost an infection into modern Wall Street. M&A itself now, I think, is much more sober business, and the people doing it are much more sober than they were.
Literally, actually.
Literally, yeah. Yes. But I think that the financial crisis is a direct descendant of the 1980s. There's a direct link between investment bankers urging their clients to buy more and bid more to investment bankers selling subprime mortgages that brought us to where we are today.
Was there one deal? Is there one deal that you can trace the beginning of modern mergers and acquisitions to?
Well, I think there are two. One is the takeover of Revlon by Ron Perlman. Mm-hmm. They made ruthless fun of him, the board of directors of the company. They just assumed with his small company called Pantry Pride, he would never be able to take it over. They called him Ron Perelman, and they called his company Panty Pride. But he did it. And the second one is TWA happened in 1985. Before much of M&A law had coalesced, Carl Icahn took it over.
Of course, yeah.
Yes.
Where did you get this title, A Giant Cow Tipping by Savages? It's catchy. I'll give you that.
That is what Ted Turner said about the merger of AOL and Time Warner. But I like the title because it also conveys the image of a contented corporate America surrounded by its high fence, not letting any other people in, and happily grazing. And then the so-called savages changed the world.
John Weir Close, his book on mergers and acquisitions is called A Giant Cow Tipping by Savages. Might be the best book title I've ever read on this radio show, by the way. John, thanks very much for your time.
Thank you very much.
The way electronic commerce works right now, it's easier than it's ever been to buy something online. Shoes, music, contact lenses, you name it, except perhaps tickets to live events, baseball playoff games, for instance, or concerts, because the human hand can't click fast enough to beat a good ticket bot. But California and a couple of other states have new laws that'll switch off those automated ticket buying programs. From Capital Public Radio in Sacramento, Katie Orr explains.
I'm a Justin Timberlake fan, and my best friend is too. So earlier this year, when we heard JT was coming to San Francisco, we decided to get tickets to his show. We logged on to Ticketmaster, already dreaming of dancing in the aisles. I can't wait till I get you on the floor good looking. You can imagine our shock when Ticketmaster told us there were no tickets left. The likely reason it sold out so fast? Ticket bots. Scalpers use online bots to digitally jump to the front of the line and scoop up all the tickets before regular fans have a shot at buying any. My friend and I did find tickets on the web, if we were willing to pay three times the face value. It's a story Dr. Richard Pan, a Democratic state assemblyman from Sacramento, has heard many times before.
What's the country singer now? Taylor Swift, I think, is coming here to Sacramento. You know when the tickets are going to sale and you log on a minute later and they're all gone. I mean, that's extremely frustrating.
So Pan authored a bill banning the use of automated ticket bot programs in California. Bots are active across the country and about a dozen states have laws trying to limit them. Andrew Zimblist is an economics professor at Smith College. He says bot programs are sophisticated. A bot doesn't just immediately resell the tickets. Instead, it holds on to them for a while.
It can sell those tickets at its leisure. If it tried to sell all of the tickets at once, it might drive the price down. But if it sells them slowly over time, it can maintain a higher price.
So will this law and others like it around the country really help consumers?
California's anti-bot law was definitely a step in the right direction.
Chris Grimm is with Fan Freedom, a national organization that advocates for ticket buyers. He doubts the law will result in many criminal charges.
We would have liked to have seen a requirement that ticket sellers have to report evidence of bot use, to the proper authorities so they can go after and prosecute these bad actors.
Using ticket bots is now a misdemeanor in California. Among those who were in support of the law were Ticketmaster and StubHub. But in the battle of man versus machine, it's likely the bots will continue evolving, and states will have to change laws to keep up. And as for me and my friend, well, the bots got the best of us. We ended up forking over the cash to see Justin Timberlake, and we both thought he was worth every penny. Take back the night. In Sacramento, I'm Katie Orr for Marketplace.
Marketplace is produced in association with the University of Southern California's Annenberg School for Communication and Journalism.
This final note today, in which Starbucks finally jumps the shark after insisting for years that a skinny soy vanilla triple pump whatever with whipped cream on it is actually somehow coffee, here is where we find ourselves now. Ad Age is reporting that Starbucks has made a trademark filing for the word physio. People who know way more about these things than I do suspect it may mean the company is going to get into fizzy drinks. I prefer not to contemplate that at all. Large drip, please. Dark roast if you got it. All right, we're done. That's Marketplace from APM on this Monday. Today, the Dow up 64 points, 0.4%. The NASDAQ gained 23 points, 0.6%. The S&P 500 rose 6 points. That is 0.4%. Our daily production team includes Bridget Bodner and Lana Anwar. Millie Jefferson directs the show. Chow Tu is our digital producer. I'm Kai Rizdahl. We'll see you tomorrow, everybody. And this is APM.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.